Haven't seen you in a long time, Ms. Brown.
I know.
Welcome
I'm
back.
Trying to stay out of trouble. May it please the court, Nancy Barron on behalf of Mr. Mariano Alvarez. He's raised two issues in this appeal, one challenging his right to be free from former jeopardy as a consequence of the trial court's declaration of a mistrial, which we contend was not based on manifest necessity. His second issue is the court's sua sponte decision to do the interdistrict transfer at the conclusion of the trial. In the absence of the necessary record required to be made.
It's only an interdivisional transfer.
That's what I mean, interdivisional. I apologize for that. Turning first to the jeopardy issue, this case obviously had gone on for quite a long period of time. There were many, many counts. It was a wiretap case. The wiretaps were in Spanish. The jury was deliberating for quite some period of time. Early on, and the third day of their deliberations, they indicated that they hadn't been able to agree. However, the court urged them, in light of the length of the trial, to continue on. The jury did continue on, and there was never a note, again, that there was any deadlock issue. However, on the Friday before the mistrial was declared, after about approximately 7 days of argument, the foreperson sent out a note saying that one of the jurors had brought in extraneous information to the jury, specifically a UPS label on one of the last counts about shipping cocaine through UPS services. The foreperson reported to the court that the jurors felt that this was wrong and felt it was important to bring it to the court's attention. After that, things happened. The court did explore the possibility of seating an alternate. This was an alternative that was agreed to by the government. It was an alternative that was agreed to by Mr. Alvarez and his counsel. The court was able to determine that the alternate was available, was ready and available to testify on the following Monday.
But not all the defendants agreed on the proper course of action.
Not all the defendants agreed, Your Honor, but on the other hand, I don't believe that the court granted the mistrial on the basis of any sort of consent, that he granted it on four specific grounds, none of which were the consent of the defense. I just want to briefly, and I hope that this is appropriate, to address the government's argument here. The government basically has indicated that the court's decision to grant this manifestly necessary mistrial was based upon its intuition that there was misconduct beyond the extraneous conduct of bringing in the UPS label, and that this somehow was subsequently corroborated by later information. And I think this is, number one, it seems to me at the very least an inference stacking problem, and number two, the court did not, as it said it would, bring the jurors out to question them about whether or not this UPS label had infected their impartiality.
Two quick questions,
yeah.
I'm watching your clock go down.
I know, me too.
Is there any mistrial law that would allow a court to affirm the mistrial based on later developed evidence?
Well, I'm not sure that there is, and I'm not sure that this court ever said it was based on later developed.
And is now a factual question. Is the record absolutely clear that there was no awareness of the subsequent misconduct at the time of the mistrial order?
Well, I think the record evidence is clear. May I finish my sentence?
Yes, well, I'm sorry.
If the court's findings are looked at, even at the subsequent hearing, he relates them back to the conduct of the juror,
yes,
at the original trial, and does not ever say that there were other grounds for the basis of the mistrial.
Thank you, Ms. Barron.
Thank you,
Mr. Salazar.
May it please the court, holding counsel, co-counsel. Mr. Flores brings up four points, but I'd like to touch on three of them. First of all, I'd like to touch up on the transfer. We did object at the trial level, the transfer from the Houston to the Houston division, and the reason was in McAllen, and this is something that's common knowledge. Judge Crane knows that. Every single defense attorney in this room knows that. In McAllen, you have a jury of the peers. Everybody spoke Spanish, every juror. We didn't need an interpreter. We needed any interpretation. And we knew that. The judge could have transferred it to Brownsville. It didn't. Could have transferred it to Laredo. That is a more...
One thing that distinguishes this case from several of the other pertinent cases that were briefed and that we've looked at is that part of the conspiracy occurred in Houston. So Houston had a legitimate claim to be a venue for this trial.
Well, maybe for the conspiracy, but not to be tried among the juries of their peers. That's number one. The other thing is that the indictment was not brought in Houston. It was brought in the McAllen Division. Therefore, the court could have sent it to Brownsville. It didn't, because they know it's a predominantly Hispanic area.
Well, the objection's a little unclear, because you did say, let's go to Corpus Christi. But is the objection on the base, are you making a Sixth Amendment argument? Doesn't seem like you could be an intra-district transfer, right?
Well, and it could be an intra-district, but I'm kind of piggybacking on Ms. Barron's argument. One of them is there was no justifiable reason, one. And then the only reason.
But a judge wouldn't know you needed a reason if you say to him, transfer's fine. We just want to go to Corpus Christi. There wasn't an objection saying, we want Rule 18 balancing.
We actually, Mr. Gochal-Ramirez at the trial level did ask to go to Corpus Christi. He said that would be a lot more convenient. It'd be closer for the defendants.
Doesn't that waive the balancing complaint that is built on a lot of our case law? In other words, if you're saying we accept that Rule 18 allows balancing for the convenience and the administration, we just would rather go to Corpus Christi, does that preserve an argument on appeal that he didn't comply with our Rule 18 case law?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that's for the court to decide.
Yeah. But the government isn't arguing waiver.
But our argument is basically you took him out of a jury of his peers. As we know, the jury pools are much different in the Houston area. And I think, I raised the argument that trial that basically the court was aiding, and not abetting, but was aiding the prosecution in trying to get this conviction. That was the one.
Would an erroneous transfer be subject to harmless error review?
Yes.
It would be.
Yes.
So, the irony, I think, is if we were to agree with you and therefore vacate retrial, the district judge would properly transfer it immediately again, now knowing what happened in McAllen, right? With the jury misconduct evidence, wouldn't that be absent?
Well, the jury misconduct evidence was afterwards.
Afterwards, but now.
And we don't know. I mean, I don't have access to the FBI agents as to if they were following this gentleman to begin with, because there was some accusations during trial that this defendant was following another juror, was attempting to speak to a female juror. So I don't know what the FBI has. That's one of them. The other issue that I'd like to move on to is the issue of emails. We specifically requested emails, all the documents in their Jenks material. And the government filed very, very wisely. They filed under seal all of these emails that they had. And they told the court, and luckily the Fifth Circuit unsealed them, that this was a representative sample of the emails. And the government knew, and the court knew, that there was more emails. And their expert testified they could only go back 2 weeks at trial, when in fact all of the emails that were sent under seal, every single one of those emails had to do with Jenks material. And to this date, we still haven't seen those emails. So we feel like they kind of hid behind the log there and did not produce, and they were required to under Jenks to produce all of those emails, because they did touch on the defense.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Salazar. Your initial time has expired, and you've saved 1 minute for rebuttal. Mr. Garcia?
May it please the court. I represent Guadalupe Hernandez in this case, and I'd like to touch up a little bit on the transfer issue, if I may, Your Honor. The court had addressed the factual issues that some of the conspiracy took place in Houston. That line of logic would arguably lead someone to anywhere in Atlanta or some other district where this conspiracy took place. I'd like to draw the court's attention to Gurley, wherein the case was transferred from Houston to Laredo. But in that case, the defendants were indicted for importation of cocaine. That's at 168 F3rd 165. I think that case was a little bit more on point in regards to the transfer and the defendant arguing that it shouldn't have been transferred. But, you know, the case initially started at a checkpoint there, and the cocaine, although the defendant was arrested here in Houston, he was taken back to trial where the cocaine had originated from. He was charged with importation. In this case, it's a conspiracy case.
At your trial in Houston, it was before the same judge.
It was, Your Honor.
Was there any objection made to preserve a record showing that there was prejudice to witnesses getting there? At any point, did you move to retransfer back?
Your Honor, we did not move to retransfer. Yeah.
Or even just say it's limiting our ability to try this case?
We didn't say that, Your Honor. However, at jury selection, our clients, Mr. Harkrider and my client, were taken into custody. We then had to take custody of their vehicles and their personal belongings. I know there's no record of that, but logistically, I mean, the record is clear. We called no witnesses. There were no witnesses that could travel up for either brother to come and testify here. Their family never attended the trial.
Counsel,
in regards to the objection, yes, Your Honor.
Were all of the defendants in custody when they moved to Houston?
No, Your Honor. No, Guadalupe.
Were any of them out on bail?
Yes, Your Honor. Abraham and Guadalupe were out on bail. They were taken into custody the first day of jury selection here.
Taken in custody up here? They came on their own?
Yes, Your Honor. They drove up in their own vehicle, rented a room here. We stayed a few blocks from the courthouse, and they were taken into custody. They gave us their keys. We then went and took their belongings.
Is a transfer order, if it's erroneous, subject to harmlessness analysis?
I believe that it is. Yeah. But in this case, the court, sua sponte just decided to transfer the case from McAllen to Houston. The court there, although there was no written objection, the court there on the record allowed all defendants. One objection from either defendant applied to all defendants is what I recall the court telling us on the record. And so the fact that Mr.
I did look for that in the record. I don't remember that the briefs gave a pinpoint site. Do you happen to have that?
I
top here?
Don't have the page number, Your Honor. I apologize.
That's all right.
G. Allen Ramirez, Mr. Alvarez's trial attorney, did bring up on that February date that Corpus was much closer. By no means did Guadalupe Hernandez concede or offer his willingness to travel to Corpus, and we just joined the objection of other co-defendants with the case.
Counsel, have you a case that interprets the word peers as meaning anything in connection with the language spoken?
I'm not sure I understand the court's question. The peers?
Well, is that you keep saying that they were entitled to a location that was a trial before their peers. What, if anything, do you have that says that your fact that the language of the jury panel in the Valley would be different from the language of the jury panel up here?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record to reflect that a jury panel in McAllen would be different than a jury panel in Houston.
I thought that was part of the complaint you were making.
Part of the complaint that I'm making, Your Honor, is based on Lipscomb and on Garza and that case law and how the court applied the factors under Rule 18 and the transfer. And the improper transfer is our position that the transfer from McAllen to Houston, in effect, was forum shopping by the court, with all due respect.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Thank Garcia. You. Mr. Harkrider?
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Derek Harker. I'm here representing Abraham Hernandez. He's the fourth defendant in this appeal. First, I'm just going to address real quickly the issue about the transfer of the case. from McAllen to Houston. I'm not going to go over a lot of the issues, but I do just want to point out in the record, like under Rule 18, about considering the factors, convenience of the defendants and the witnesses, is that with all due respect to Judge Crane, who I have no problems with him as a judge. I think he's a very fair judge and a smart judge. But he did state when he was transferring and there was objections, he said, I don't believe I'm required to disclose or state any reason. This is Southern District of Texas. It's one venue. I can move cases within the division, sua sponte, for whatever reason, and that's what I choose to do. And I think that was at USCA 5, pages 27, 15 to 16. So that's, I just want to point that out to the court.
Counsel, do you know of any local rule of the Southern District of Texas that would bear on this issue of transfer?
No, Your Honor, I sure don't. Other than just the federal rule 18.
Rule 18 is, we've of course looked at it. I'm asking, do you know whether the judges of the Southern District have adopted any local rule that speaks to the question of transfer between divisions?
No, Your Honor, I don't.
You think there is none, or you know there is none?
I don't know, Your Honor.
You okay?
The second issue, Your Honor, I brought up six issues in the appeal. That the first one was the same one that the other defendants brought up. The second one was this. We did do a pretrial motion for severance. The reason is the record shows that the two target defendants were Mariano Alvarez and Mr. Eden Flores, Sr. I think my client was a very peripheral player in this whole conspiracy. He came in late, real late in the conspiracy. There was lots of drug seizures. There was lots of seizures of weapons. There was lots of seizures of large amounts of cash before my client ever came in. So I'd asked the judge for a severance, and that was denied. I think that alone may not have merited a severance, but there was also other reasons, which was that there was a statement by my client's brother, Guadalupe Hernandez, who said and confessed that he was part of the drug conspiracy and that he was involved with Eden Flores in this drug conspiracy. Now, they took out the part where he said his brother, which is my client, was involved also under, I guess, a Bruton issue. But I think the implication there, it's hard to avoid or to think that the jury would somehow not prejudice my client when they heard that his own brother confessed to being part of the conspiracy. So that was one of the reasons also.
How did the jury know that there was a brother-brother relation?
Because that came out, that was clear through the testimony, at least of Marco Antonio Negrete and various, I believe, DEA agents. I don't think there was any dispute that they were brothers. So I think that was probably the most prejudicial effect. And the fact is that the brother Guadalupe Hernandez Sr. also had prior drug trafficking convictions.
Is the Guadalupe confession in the record in its redacted form and in the full form?
I believe it was in oral. It was redacted. It wasn't a written confession.
It was
never oral.
Submitted in writing. It's just the testimony of the witness describing the confession?
Correct, yes, Your Honor. The other issue, Your Honor, was also on the search warrant. There was a search warrant that was issued on my client's house or where he lived, his parents' house. Two issues on that was, I believe it was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. On the face of the search warrant, it stated that the judge signed it, that it has to be, executed before October 24th, 2007. It was executed on October 25th, 2007. Now, the government brought up that there's a good faith exception and that they have to be objectively reasonable. I think just the face of the warrant itself, it says, you know, it's in plain language. It says it had to be executed on October 24th. It was executed a day later. So we think that was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. The other issue was that I don't believe it was supported by sufficient probable cause. It was conclusive. The only evidence against my client and the affidavits supporting the search warrant was a confidential informant who wasn't identified that just stated that he knew that my client was involved in this drug conspiracy, and it was back in 2005, and I believe spring of 2006, search warrant wasn't executed, or I'm sorry, spring 2007, the search warrant wasn't executed till October 25th, 2007. So in other words, the last event that confidential informant gave, the search warrant wasn't until 8 months later, which I think is stale.
Thank you.
My time's up.
Yes.
Thank you,
Mr.
for
Arkwright, your time
thank
has
you.
Expired.
Thank you, Justices.
Mr. Turner.
May it please the court and counsel. I think the question before the court is the clarity of the objection with respect to the transfer to Houston. And that requires, I think, an assessment of at least three different proceedings, three distinct proceedings. The first was...
Did you argue waiver in the brief to us?
We did not argue waiver, Your Honor, waiver, of course, would be, again, we're dealing with standard review. I believe the well-settled rule is that the parties can't affect this court standard of review.
No, but whether we apply Rule 52, plain error analysis would depend on if the government waived the opportunity to argue waiver, and I didn't see your brief adjust.
We did not argue waiver, no, Your Honor. But at the same time, I think we have to assess precisely what happened before the district court so we can discuss the aspect of harmless error as well.
But did you elaborate any harmlessness analysis in your brief?
Your Honor, we did not elaborate upon the harmlessness aspect of it, but I think it's clear from this record that if there's error, the error is harmless. Our position is that there was no error preserved.
That's the only position that you presented to us. No, not that it was preserved. You argued there was no error in the
no
district.
Error.
Yeah.
And I would rest upon that because I want to show the court that there's no error in this particular instance by virtue of what happened in the court below, if I may.
Yeah.
And I begin with what happened on December the 5th. And this whole thing is precipitated by the jury note from the juror foreman with respect to Maximo Gonzalez and how the court's aware of the fact that Maximo Gonzalez, juror number 6, has injected something into the court which turns out to be the selection of UPS stickers. And at that point in time, there's a series of objections that go forth, and Abraham Hernandez's counsel actually objects to the fact that he objects to letting the juror go by virtue of the fact that now the entire jury is infected with this and you're going to infect the jury and renew it by letting this juror go. The judge contemplates different things to do at this point in time. The one thing he's certain of, he's going to dismiss the juror. And there's no objection. There's no objection laws at that juncture. In fact, the judge says at that point in time, I'm not going to grant a mistrial sua sponte unless someone moves for it. At which time, counsel for Aiden Flores moves for a mistrial. The judge says that's premature. I want to consider this over the weekend. He does, and we turn to December the 8th. December the 8th, there's a lengthy discussion about how to handle the juror dismissal. That question, it turns on, do we go with 11? Do we go with 11 in an alternate or not? In the end, once again, first in the beginning of that process, counsel for Aiden Flores withdraws his motion for mistrial. But at the end of the process, counsel for the... Mr. Salazar, not Mr. Salazar, excuse me, again, it's Abraham Hernandez, Mr. Harkrider. Mr. Harkrider moves for a mistrial, and his basis is the juror misconduct has infected the totality of the jury. At that point in time is when the judge says, I'm going to grant the motion for mistrial, and I'm going to move this case to Houston. At that time, the only objection that's lodged comes from and it is testing the convenience of the parties. No one addresses any convenience. No one says, I'm going to bring any evidence or I'm not going to be able to get my people to Houston. There's a suggestion we go to Corpus Christi. The court says, no, we're going to Houston. Then we come to the February 26th proceeding, and I'm going to have to use the docket entry for the court because everyone in this case has a transcript. And my docket entry is docket entry 789 at page 12. What leads up to this is the court's, there's a suggestion that the judge is ironically jury shopping. The judge says, there's no evidence of that. There's no evidence of jury shopping. There's a suggestion of it. The judge considers it, and at the end of it, he says to them, look, it's going to be removed. And during the course of the discussion, now counsel for Alvarez suggests, well, it's good for the mistrial, so everybody's in accord with the mistrial. We have no objections to the mistrial from Mr. Alvarez, but we do object to the transfer. We want to know why you're going to transfer. They don't object to the transfer. They suggest, why are you transferring it? And the judge offers again his reason that, well, first off, he says, I guess being provoked, he suggests, I don't have to give you any reasons. At the end of that discussion, he says, but look, I'll consider submissions, because if you'll note the phrasing, I don't believe I have to give any reasons. No one refers him to Rule 18. No one suggests any inconvenience. No one suggests, and this is in February, that there's going to be any any problem. The next setting is in July. And in July, the two defendants that are on bond, Abraham and Guadalupe Hernandez, but first Guadalupe Hernandez, by that point in time, the government has learned through their investigation that Mr. Maximo Gonzalez not only injected UPS stickers in there, he'd been in conference with two of the defendants at that point in time. So at that point in time, there's no objection now to the transfer. There's no motions for return. And if you look at the Lipscomb and Garza cases, and there, all the appellants zealously moved to have their case transferred back to the original venue. Here, there's nothing but resounding silence with respect to any objection to the transfer. So I would suggest to the court, at that point in time, the judge knew, not by intuition, by July, with no objections having been lodged, no request to move it back, nothing in February, the judge knew there was an investigation, and at that point in time, the government tenders the testimony of his agent that it will show we have tapes with the juror that he worked with two of the defendants to move this case, to stall this case or to work a result in this case. So the judge knew by July, before the case started, the second trial started, that there, not jury misconduct had affected the totality of the jury. There was clearly manifest necessity for the retrial. And I would also suggest at that point in time, the overall record, the totality of this record, supports the court's finding that the transfer was required from McGowan to clear the jury pool.
Well, the problem is there are various arguments you weave together, and two of which you didn't make in the brief. I mean, primarily what I hear you saying is they didn't properly object under Rule 18 at the time that he entered his order, so therefore no reasons came out. Then at the next hearing where they do object, he says, I don't have to give reasons. If that were the entire record, that's inconsistent with Lipscomb, right?
Yes, and Garza.
Right.
And a point, Your Honor, there's a preceding in between that. There's the Friday discussion, then there's the Monday discussion when he decides to make it, and then there's the February discussion on the record. The first one they objected, let's go to Corpus Christi in the Friday, December the 8th, then on February 26th, they want to know, why are we moving this from McAllen to Houston?
Right.
And they all indicated to the judge, we're going to move to recuse you. And the judge says, fine, you can file your motions, but it's going to Houston. No motions came out. There was it was a resounding silence. The records, there's no objection whatsoever.
It's just hard to establish just strictly legally how this could be consistent with Lipscomb if he says, I'm not going to give reasons and I don't have to give reasons.
Well, actually, and then I would qualify that in this particular instance. In Lipscomb, there was a true request for these reasons. Here, there's no request at all for the reasons.
I thought they asked him, what are your reasons?
And then he said, I believe I don't have to give any reasons. Again, it's sort of a hedging, and at the same time, he's inviting them, I could be wrong. And there's no one responding to that second suggestion. And you look at the page 12 and 13 of that specific docket entry, you will
Counsel,
see
let me ask right there. Do you know of anything in the local rules of the Southern District of Texas that speaks to the question of the criteria that you need to transfer between divisions?
No, Your Honor, I don't know anything in the local rules that touches upon that. I would also suggest with respect to Spanish-speaking jurors, Title 28 is clear the jurors are qualified to speak English. And so I would suggest that with respect to that issue, it's...
Do all circuits interpret Rule 18 the way we do, that it even applies to intra-district transfers?
You know, Your Honor, I honestly cannot...
Because it doesn't, the plain language doesn't.
No. And I don't think there's any, especially here, this district is so big, I don't think there's such any intra-district transfers of this nature, especially of this nature. I mean, the Western District is where Lipscomb and Garza came from, and we have this case from here. So there's very few cases on this point, and none of them have the aspect of two defendants working with a jury.
It was mentioned earlier that the prejudice could be they couldn't call witnesses when they got to Houston. Had they called witnesses at their trial in McAllen?
To my honor, I don't believe they did. And if they did, they didn't make any record of it. So there was no, I mean, as far as the convenience in calling witnesses, the record, again, is silent with respect to that. I mean, there's absolutely no evidence of convenience. I think that the burden is upon them to show the substantial harm to their interest in this case.
Counsel, in the Lipscomb case, was there any holding by the trial judge that there was a mistrial of any kind?
Your Honor, as I recall, there wasn't. I believe those two cases involved, I think, recusal, but I, at this point in time, I can't be certain of that. But I don't believe there was any issue of mistrial, but I don't recall.
Does the government take the position that it would not have been appropriate just to bring in the alternate juror?
We were prepared to bring in whatever everybody agreed upon. We were prepared, I think, to go with the alternate juror. He was brought in. In fact, he had an overnight truck driver. I think the record shows that he was a truck driver, had been brought back to see if he would be able to participate in the proceedings. In fact, I think our first suggestion was qualify the alternate juror, recharge the jury, and go forward with that. So we were prepared to go forward at that point in time. Again, the objection finally came from Abraham Hernandez, as I recall, and that was that he moved for a mistrial because he believed the entire jury was infected by this guy's conduct. He probably thought it was solely by virtue of the UPS discussion. In fact, that's what's on the record. He said this UPS discussion seems to indicate that the entire jury panel is discussing something that's not germane.
Did Judge Crane determine that there was a mistrial in the first case?
Yes, he did. He did. He ordered mistrial as soon as it was asked for by Mr. Hernandez's counsel.
Based on the long deadlock plus the extraneous contact?
The extraneous contact, precisely. Again, on the remainder of the issues, unless the court has any additional questions.
I was just, you could go through the email situation. What they asked pretrial for all Jenks, and their request listed emails. And then did the government say, those have to be shown to be material? What happened there?
What happened, as I recall in this record, and I think the record will show, this is 2007. The technology for bringing up all these emails at that point in time, and I would guess even the day, it was somewhat difficult to put them all together. Our response was we'd have to bring our expert in. We brought an expert from DEA in that would collect the emails. And this was before the Department of Justice instituted its protocols on electronic communications. And we were eventually able to draw up a block of emails. The two that were set out as an example were basically logistical, if anything. And in the end, I don't think that we gave them to the judge.
The district judge?
The district judge.
It sealed ex parte?
Yes.
I see.
Yes. And then after that, again, the record rings silent with respect to any request.
Did the district court then say these aren't material, or did the district court? Do you remember what the district?
I don't think there was anything further from this. I recall from the record there could have been, but I don't recall them saying anything. Again, the difficulty with this record is that there were lots of things the judge would take under advisement, and then there were no rulings gleaned from the defense parties.
Counsel, my recollection is that the Lipscomb case was fairly far back in time. Am I remembering that correctly?
I believe it's 290 something or other, Fed Third, Your Honor. So it would be, I think that would be the early 2000s. So I'm not sure of the time on that. I'd have to check my the brief.
Has there been any other reference in the Southern District of Texas to Lipscomb as controlling the issue of transfer among divisions?
Actually, Your Honor, as far from this court or any other court, I don't think there's been any Rule 18 contentions from the Southern District of Texas. I believe Lipscomb and Garza, which was the second case, both came out of the Western District of Texas. So, again, if there's no additional questions, I'll yield the remainder of the time and rest on the brief.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. Mr. Salazar, you save 1 minute for rebuttal. Oh, is it Ms. Barron instead? All right. The sheet that I have says Mr. Salazar. All right, Ms. Barron.
Thank you. Just in short order, I would just direct the court's attention to the February 26th status conference before the second trial. And there the court stated that the basis for the mistrial was extraneous information that was brought before the jury into the deliberative process, which in his opinion poisoned the jurors and rendered them unable to reach an impartial verdict. You know, there's just nothing on the record on this. This is his assumption, and the government describes this as the court's intuition, an intuition which went beyond the introduction of the UPS label, which the government itself characterizes as mere investigation. The jury was prompt into saying that this was misconduct. They were a deliberating jury, and the court indicated its desire to talk to the jurors individually and then dispensed with that procedure altogether. I know that, you know, that the issue, that it's abuse of discretion. On the other hand, may I finish this sentence?
You may.
That this sort of thing is to be done, you know, with the strictest sort of scrutiny, that there are no other reasonable alternatives. Thank you. We ask that our jeopardy argument be granted. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Barron. The case is under submission. Oh, did you also reserve a minute?
I did.
All right, you may. Go ahead. That's fine. I just have erroneous information here. I'm sorry.
We apologize, but we did 4-1. If it pleases the court, again, just briefly on rebuttal, on the emails, one of the things is that the court was aware, and the government is very, very crafty in this. When they put their, there is, they use phrases like a series of transmissions seeking. It's not including some of the responses, and the DEA specialty, the guru, testified, we can get them. We can if the court orders us. And the best proof that they could get them is that the U.S. attorney actually had them.
Right, but Jenks, you don't turn things over unless they're material. And so if they submitted them to the court, presumably there was a materiality assessment done?
And I'd ask, well, I have a problem, because if you look, and I've placed in my brief, I've made a couple of examples, and you have the rest of them under seal. And they're specifically talking about the drug trafficking in South Texas with Mariano Alvarez with the $279,000, those are material. Those are from the case agent to another agent. And they're in those, if you go through all of those emails, there is at least two federal agents, three with it's Agent Hernandez, Agent Alba, Agent Coleman, confidential informant Olvides, confidential informant Barrera, and cooperating witness Jose Luis Canas. Those are specifically mentioned in the emails. Those are very material. Those are people that testified for the government. They are the case agent. And for the government to hide behind the log and say, oh, sorry, the defense hasn't made their case because they haven't proved their material. But, oh, by the way, Judge, here's a sample of what we have. And then they bring their expert. Their expert says, we can only go back two weeks. Please, okay. Who's going to believe that? The court knew. The court had it under seal. They knew they could go back. These emails go back 2.5 years. They knew they could go. The government knew they could go back, yet they hid behind the log and they did not disclose it because they did not want to disclose others that this court and we have still not seen to date.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Salazar.
Thank you.